This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. It wasn't until the early 1900s that women in Germany could attend the university. But when that barrier was lifted, Hedwig Cohn didn't hesitate. She worked as a physicist before World War II, and it wouldn't take long for her to see physics as her ticket out of Nazi Germany. Hedwig Cohn found herself teaching at the University of North Carolina Women's College in Greensboro. And after stints at other universities, she would return to North Carolina to continue her research at Duke. Fellow physicist Brenda Winnewiser took a special interest in Hedwig Cohn's story. Brenda Winnewiser is a professor of physics at Ohio State University, and she joins us today on The State of Things. It's Science Week, and Brenda, welcome to you.
Talking to you.
Good to talk with you. Tell us a little bit about Hedwig Cohn. Who is she? Where was she born? How did she get interested in physics?
She was the daughter of a rather well-to-do family in Breslau, which is in the eastern part of what was then Germany. Today it's the city of Wrocław in Poland. It was not possible for her to enter the university until 1908. As a matter of fact, for that same reason, there was no secondary school preparation for young women at that time. And so as she took some courses which were supposed to be enough so she could enter as an auditor, which had been allowed for the last 10 years, the young women realized that their science teaching and their math and science teaching was pretty miserable because, as she said, after all, what self-respecting teacher was going to take a job teaching young women at that time? I mean, just girls. So they hired the best teacher from the best secondary high school for boys in Breslau, the same man who taught people whose names would be familiar in internationally, actually, Fritz Haber, Max Born, physicist and a chemist and a historian, Mommsen, and even a dramatist, Gerhard Hauptmann. And he did a very good job. He was a very inspiring teacher, as witnessed to by some of these other former students. And this is really all we know how she got interested in physics. But she was an optimist, you can tell, because when she got her secondary school's admission to the university, it was 1907, and she signed up as an auditor. And she didn't care whether they were letting women in yet or not. If they could get in as auditors, she was going to be in the game.
So she gets in. She's interested in physics. Obviously, she had some good tutoring going into this. Was there anyone, I mean, clearly if women weren't in the university, there couldn't be many women physicists that she could look up to. Were there any inspirations or models for her?
She did have some role models, not necessarily in physics, but in studying science in Breslau. There was a young woman who was the daughter of the Bürgermeister, even, who'd managed to get special permission to get a medical degree. And there was another young woman who had studied chemistry and later on became the wife of another very even more famous chemist. But this was before they were formally allowed. She was the first crop. She was in the first crop who could enter as regular students. So, yes, role models are extremely important. And she probably knew these other young women personally. This was – they were all three of them part of the Jewish community of Breslau, and they probably knew each other's families.
What kind of physics? What was her area of study? It's a very interesting time to be studying physics, certainly the turn of the 20th century.
It's hard for me as a physicist to look back and imagine when we didn't know how the atom was put together. Yeah. We didn't know anything about nuclear science. We didn't know anything about lasers. All of this came much later, and there were strange things that were being discovered, these fancy particles like alpha particles and gamma rays, and they didn't really even know what to call them. She was part of the generation which struggled with these new phenomena and were fascinated by them. She was a student of Otto Luhmer, who was famous for measuring radiation intensity. In other words, not just what color are the strange discrete light emissions that the atoms put out if you put them in a flame, but how intense are these emissions that the atoms can send out if they are excited by heat or by other forms, sources of light. So she became an expert in flame spectroscopy and for the purpose of measuring intensities. And this carried her actually through to the end of her life.
She does get an appointment at a university, one of three women perhaps in the German Academy at the time. What was her reception? Obviously, she's unique, and she's Jewish, as you point out. And while this is, she gets the appointment before the Nazis come to power, anti-Semitism is certainly powerful in Europe at the time.
You're certainly right there, but you're actually assuming a too positive situation in her getting an appointment. She was appointed a so-called assistant, which is sort of like somewhere between an instructor and a lab assistant. And this she was appointed to the year after she got her degree, her PhD, in 1913, that was. So from 1914 until she left Germany, actually, officially, this was her position. Mm. And it was paid at a very low level. She could, although women could enter the university, they were not allowed yet to get the super degree called the habilitation, which allowed them to qualify for a professorial position. So she could not be a professor. Mm. And this restriction on letting women into the club remained formally until the late 1920s, and informally since that period became very close to the Nazi period, and the Nazis saw no role for women in the university. This, the admission of women into the professorship in general lasted until the end of the Second World War.
Oh. So what happens now when the Nazis take power? What happens to Hedwig Cohn?
Well, first she loses her position. She is moved to her room, that which used to be quite close to the front of the Institute, was moved to the back of the Institute. And this sounds like, well, if they were hiding her. Well, yes, in a way they were hiding her, but this was a positive step. The professor who ran the Institute, and in those days the professor really was a monarch in a small kingdom, he had a sort of a benevolent, protective feeling and knew how valuable she was to the Institute and wanted to keep her. And she said, don't try to leave, Hedwig, stay in Germany. I will make sure that you have employment. And he did. He ascertained for her, or he secured for her, contracts with the light bulb industry that was doing research and needed measurements that they couldn't do in their own laboratories. And from 1934 to 1938, she was doing laboratory work, making measurements, and had a little office in the back of the Institute. And one of her former students told me, we didn't know why they'd moved her there, but we figured it out later, because for the technical things that the professor was otherwise involved in, there would be important party people coming into the Institute, and it would be dangerous for her as well as for the position of the Institute if she was found near the front door. But the students always found her.
The students found her. So she was not only working for this light bulb company, and I suspect that's where her income was coming from, but she was also working with students. So she did have a role with the university, albeit a secret one.
She was still advising students. She was defined by the government, the Nazi government, as unfit to teach. Yet the professor was letting her be the day-to-day advisor for several students right through this entire Nazi period up until 1940.
But at a certain point, by 1938, was it? It did become untenable.
The government managed to make it impossible even for big companies like Siemens, AEG, to Osram Light Bulb Company to pay Jews for work. And this went all across Germany in 1938. And at that point, the professor realized he could not encourage her to stay in Germany. She realized. This was underlined by the Kristallnacht, the 9th of November of 1938, when many, many, many Jewish synagogues were fired and stormed and vandalized across Germany in a so-called spontaneous protest, which was anything but spontaneous. And she knew then that violence was not to be ignored that her life was in danger.
What did she do?
She wrote to the there were several organizations in Britain and in the United States who were trying to help refugees, and particularly academic refugees. And she also wrote to a former Breslau colleagues, one of whom in particular, Rudolf Ladenburg, had emigrated to the U.S. already in 1931, before he actually had intended to. They offered him a job that was so good, he took it. And he started agitating among interacting with various groups. The American Association of University Women was extremely important in getting her out of Germany. The International Union of University Women and various other groups. There's too many for me to name right now. A lot of people were involved. Hundreds of letters went back and forth across the Atlantic, across Europe, within the U.S.
Getting her out was one thing, but it's 1938, and it's pretty hard to find work anywhere. How difficult was it for her to find a position? And then what brought her to Greensboro?
There are always unique situations and unique people which have enormous effect. And the person who brought her to Greensboro, really, was Hertha Sponer, another woman physicist who had left Germany not because she was Jewish but because she was a woman. And she had made it to being associate professor in Göttingen. But her position was not tenured, and it was made very clear to her that a year later she would have no job, so she left. And in North Carolina, not only at Duke University and UNC, but colleges across North Carolina, there's a remarkable number of German refugee scholars who found a home in North Carolina. And one of these was Hertha Sponer. In 1936, she was hired as a physics professor to help build up the new young physics department of the new young university of Duke University. She began trying to help find a job for Hedwig Cohn. They'd known each other in Germany, but just from conferences. They were not friends. They had lived too far apart, and their work didn't overlap. And she bothered the president of the UNC repeatedly, until the secretary one day left a note saying, "Here comes Sponer, Professor Sponer again," trying to get a position for her acquaintance and her fellow refugee. And finally, the University of North Carolina Women's College, actually their physics department, said, "Yes, we would love to have her." But the university hesitated a little bit. But they did finally offer her a position for 1 year. And this was one of 3 years' worth of offers that were obtained by hook and by crook, one from Sweetbriar, one from Wellesley College, and UNC was the first one. And so this allowed her to assure the Swedes that she had a possibility of a job, a visa based on job offers for the United States, and therefore the Swedes would give her an entry visa, and that allowed her apply to for an exit visa from Germany.
Complicated house of cards. Just to get you out, you need all those things in place. So you can sort of see how difficult it is to put all these things together. Gets this position in Greensboro. Let me ask you first, I want to find out more about Hedwig and what happened, but why were so many German scholars in North Carolina at this time?
That's an interesting question. I'm not sure if you took other states of a similar population or density of universities, if it was more. I happen to know about the ones in North Carolina because I spent time in North Carolina too. And there's a wonderful little book about it. They Fled Hitler's Germany, I think it's called, put out by UNC, that lists quite a few of them. I know there's people that landed in there's a college of arts in the mountain somewhere that provided a home for at least one. Greensboro had, besides Hedwig Cohn, an art history professor from Germany. There was Professor Manasseh at North Carolina Central, who was a teacher of philosophy. You can imagine a man who has been persecuted for his ethnicity. Having a peculiar sensitivity to his situation, teaching African-American students at at that time the only students at North Carolina Central.
Hedvig Cohen spends a year, is that right, in Greensboro, then goes on to other appointments and ultimately comes back to Duke. Is that right?
She spent, after that, she went to Wellesley and spent 10 years teaching at Wellesley and setting up an undergraduate research program and was rapidly promoted to full professor. But upon her retirement, a conventional retirement at 65, she had practically no pension. So what should she do? And she would have loved to have gotten a job in an industrial lab or a national lab. Her science was still relevant at that time, but nobody was going to hire a 65-year-old woman. I mean, just imagine it. Even today, she'd have a little bit of a hard time. And there stepped Hedda Spohner into the breach once more. And she was a very determined and straightforward person, Hedda Spohner was. And she said, well, why don't you come down to Duke? I have a research grant with the Office of Naval Research, and I'll hire you as a research associate, just like a newly graduated PhD maybe. And I'll let you do what you want to do. You don't have to work on my research. Just you write your part of the research reports, and we'll see how it goes. Well, it went very well for 10 years until she died. For 12 years. She had two graduate students who she advised. Then she had she enjoyed that so much, she got a postdoc from Germany. This was a period when she could give back, in a way, still to Germany, because Germany was still in a post-war shambles. And young scholars who wanted to get a science education, the one thing they dreamed of was to get to the U.S. for a postdoc.
What got you interested in this story?
Well, I met her. When I arrived at Duke, I was introduced in the first few days to this plump, friendly, rather grandmotherly lady who was working in the sub-basement. And lo and behold, there were two of them because there was Hedda Spohner, a very small, firm lady, very authoritative, very different. And I knew I was among the very few women studying physics at that time. We made up only 1% of the PhD population in those days of physicists. But I had no idea that there were two mature women who I would find in the sub-basement. So I didn't know her well. I was very respectful, and I didn't have any immediate reason to interact with her. But her story, the snippets of it that I heard interested me. But I more or less forgot about them for years. But I married one of those German postdocs who came over, and we went back to Germany. And I lived there for 35 years. And about halfway through that time, I realized, gee whiz, I went to Wellesley as an undergraduate, where she taught. I did my graduate work at Duke, where she spent the last 10 years, 12 years of her life. And now I have become rather thoroughly acquainted with the German academic world and many of the vestiges of the way it looked at the time she lived here. I could write something up about her. Nobody else in the world has this background to do it. And I decided I had to. So I was doing it as a side project of my physics, but I'm very happy that I embarked on it, and I found far more information than I ever hoped to.
Fascinating story, Brenda. Thank you for sharing it with us. Thanks for being on the program.
I really enjoyed the opportunity to talk about it.
Brenda Winnewizer is a professor of physics at Ohio State University. Coming up, how the pitch of a politician's voice could change the way you vote. Stay tuned.